You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, a new Wisconsin Public Television documentary celebrates the Wisconsin State Capitol. We'll get a preview.
First, local communities around Wisconsin have a lot of concerns in common. How to keep young adults from leaving town after graduation, road maintenance, access to healthcare facilities, and here's one more, providing spaces and activities for teenagers.
Our next guest says it's a common problem, especially but not only in smaller towns. Teens don't have places to get together in public or things to do, and if they want to gather in parking lots, restaurants, parks, or malls, they're not always welcome.
He says one answer to solving this problem, ask the teens themselves to come up with some solutions. Neil Clemmie joins us now. He's 4-H Youth Development Educator Department Head at the University of Wisconsin Extension in Iron County. He's based in Hurley. Neil, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, a little background. Neil, were both at a planning and design gathering in Princeton, Wisconsin. And as part of that, you and I talked to some high school students. And they said this was a big problem for them. There's no public place for them to gather. Is this something you hear in communities around the state?
Yeah, and I think not just a place for them to gather, but I think another thing that they need is to have a voice in the decisions that are being made in the community. I think it's important for kids to feel like they can contribute. Positive youth development says that kids need to be able to contribute to their community and get that sense of that they belong and that they have a say in what's happening.
Now, let's look more at the problem side of things. First of all,
sure.
If kids' voices, if youth voices aren't heard, what do we lose?
Well, as far as from a positive youth development standpoint, what kids are losing then, or what happens, is they find other ways to be heard, which could come out in communities in a negative way. They're not gathering in places that are safe. They're gathering in places that are, doing things that they don't want adults to see, and could be causing them to get in trouble.
And we hear in small towns in particular, not just small towns, that a lot of the things you might think of doing as a teen, hanging out at the theater, going roller skating, maybe going to the bowling alley, well, the theater might have closed, the skating rink probably closed, bowling alley may or may not still be there. A lot of the things that we might have associated with our youth maybe aren't even options for kids anymore.
Exactly. I know here in Hurley, we don't have a skating rink. I hear people talking all the time about back when the rink was open, when we had a skating rink. And we have a bowling alley, but it's also a bar. So is it the most appropriate place for kids to be hanging out where they're, hanging out with, there's alcohol being consumed? And is that the best thing for them, place for them to be? Our movie theater is open, but it's, again, a small town movie theater.
And let's get into how to get teens involved. And this is
sure.
Something you've been working on in Hurley and Iron County in general. And you've had some real things come out of this. But how did you get started in this process of bringing young people into plan to fill these gaps in their lives?
Okay. Well, so I started out here in Iron County back in 2012. And it was something that I really wanted to look into and address. There was some strategic planning done before I got here from our community development educator, Will Andreessen, who had really looked into how do we attract and retain young people to the Gugebic Range, to this area. And one thing that I wanted to do was to really address how do we get young people involved? Teenagers. There's young adults and that too, but I really wanted to focus on teenagers and middle school age kids because those are, especially middle school, and those are ages that they're not involved in things like this, and then they're forgotten. So I started small. I started with some initial programming that was already happening. My summer camp program, I had 30-some camp counselors, but the camp was being planned by adults mostly. So what I did was create a camp planning team where youth had a voice, helped create the plan for camp, helped design the camp programming, get involved in teaching the camp trainings, all that stuff. So they really had built some ownership in the programming and moved the program to more of a youth-led program. After that, the Iron County Fair Board here was looking for ways to how do we get more teenagers and young people to come to the fair and spend more time there? How do we increase attendance, especially with our youth? So I got them to allow a group of high school students and myself to create a survey that actually asked the kids that question. And from that, they incorporated some of the youth survey results into their plan, having bands that, young people would want to come to. I think one of the funny comment was one of the kids said, stop playing polka music, and we would come. So I think that was interesting, but it was something that they hadn't thought of. So that they worked that in, and they've been hiring a band that's more, I guess, more attractive to younger populations. And I've seen the difference. There's a lot more high school kids and middle school kids hanging out at the fair now. So it worked. I guess from there, another thing that I wanted to do was trying to connect kids to the natural features of Iron County and to the things that maybe they love about living here. One of them is Iron County has 16 waterfalls in the county, but the brochure that guided people to those waterfalls was down to the point where it was just in black and white photocopies of it, and you couldn't tell where they were or follow the directions. So the kids helped me recreate the brochure with GPS coordinates so that the people could plug it into their cell phones and find the waterfalls. A lot of the kids told me, they're like, we haven't been to those waterfalls since we were little kids, since mom and dad dragged us out there. But we all went out and checked out all these waterfalls after we made the brochure, which I think is great because, connecting kids to the assets of their community is also a key to getting them involved and getting them to want to come back, or those are the things that they're going to look for one day when they pick a home and a place to settle with their families. So I guess from there, I used the first impression tool that was created by Andy Lewis with UW Extension a couple decades ago. It's been used with adults for years, and I took it and I kind of recreated it so it was a teen program, a high school kid program. So it's a program that takes members of one community to another community, and they do kind of a community swap. So like I took a group of high school students to Montello one summer, and Montello sent a group of kids up here to Hurley. You complete this survey, and then you go back to the community and present on your findings, and you tell that community, what you liked about their downtown, what you liked about their residential areas, what you liked about their school, and all that. So it really gives exactly the youth perspective on what communities can build off of.
We're talking to Neil Clemmy, UW Extension in Iron County. He's with 4-H Youth Development there, talking about efforts to provide spaces and activities for teens. A lot of communities dealing with this problem. And he says the one key to doing this is to get the teens, the youth themselves, involved in the planning process. That's what we're talking about right now. Neil, as you worked with teens in these programs and in another one we'll talk about, what kind of reaction do you get? I would imagine if I were a teenager thinking back, I would be very surprised that the grown-ups were asking for my input and my opinions.
Right, and that's why I kind of started small, because initially when I started to ask these kind of questions to the teenagers, I got this deer in headlight look at me like, you want me to do what? No one's ever asked me that before. So you really had to start building them and giving them the skills and teaching them the things that they need to know in order to make those decisions. And I think they respected it, and I think the adults started to go to say, we should have asked you guys this a long time ago. I had one adult in the community here tell me, well, if you ask the kids, they're just going to want water parks and roller coasters. And I said, I don't think you give them quite enough credit. I think you need to give them a little more credit for their ideas. And I think after they came back and gave their feedback from the first impression strips, they really were able to go, the adults really started to see them in a different light and start seeing them as part of the solution rather than, oh, no, they're all leaving. That's the problem. How do we fix it? They started to see that these kids could help us fix it.
And if kids are civically engaged, maybe this is looking too far ahead, but if I'm a teenager in a small town and I'm looking for reasons to stay, is being engaged like this, engaged with the community, something that they're going to weigh in making that decision?
I think so. Some of the evaluation that I've done of the programs that I've been doing, some of the kids said, I never thought of all the things that I love about this community, and I never really thought about where I wanted to be when I grew up, when I got out of high school and out of college, and this really helped me reflect and decide, I do like my hometown. This is where I want to be, and it helps them gives them a sense of power and ownership in their community.
We're talking to Neil Clemmy from UW Extension, looking at how communities can provide spaces and activities for teens, in part by listening to teenagers themselves.
You can join the conversation on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Is this a problem for your community? If you're a teen, is there a place for you to go with your friends and hang out where you feel welcome? And adults, did you have something like this in your community growing up? Is it still around? Post your thoughts and see what others have to say over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up that conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Right now, we're continuing the conversation with Neil Clemmy from UW Extension in Iron County. He works with local governments to help provide activities and spaces for teens, and he brings teens on board to help in the planning process.
What do you think? Does your community have fun, safe spaces for teens to gather? If you are a teen yourself, what would you like to see in your community? Is there any way for you to give your input? Tell us what you're thinking on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Well, Neil, you had a big story in Hurley. You brought teens on to help plan things, and you ended up with a trailhead project.
Yeah.
Can you talk us through what happened?
Well, and so all those other things led to the Wisconsin design team coming to Hurley to help us. There was a committee of people that were working on developing a trail, a non-motorized trail through Hurley. And the beginning we thought we needed to do was develop a trailhead. So the trail comes across the border from the Upper Peninsula, from Ironwood over into Hurley. And we had a piece of property there and a couple other spots. And we wanted the design team to kind of help us decide which was the best spot for our trailheads on either end of the trail, east and west ends. And we had some high school kids, some seven high school kids who had participated in the first impression exchange, help us with that design. They really took the lead on giving the tours around their community. We had one who was, you know, pretty adamant, you can't have a trailhead there. This is filled with boats all summer long. You're not going to have room for people with bikes. And so they were really great because they've lived here their whole life. They know where the traffic is. They know where trailheads would work best and where these would be. And what was cool about this was with the Wisconsin design team, they got to actually sit with the designers and help draw pictures and design parks and playground equipment. And they got their hands into it and got their hands dirty and helped with the design and the presentation in the evening that we gave to the community. And some of the kids learned, you know, what they could do with their artistic ability when they're done. They're like, this is what I could do for a career. I could be a landscape architect. I could draw these things. So it was great.
We'll get into the final product in just a bit. I want to go to our callers. Ken is on the line in Madison. Ken, hi.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Ken?
Well, I was curious. Listening to the conversation, I had some ideas about possibly starting something like this in my community. It sounds kind of like a daunting task. I was wondering how much effort goes into something like this, and if you were to pursue it, who would you have to talk to? Who are the people in the community that would have to be on board to offer their support to allow you to go after areas, access, approvals?
Ken, thanks. If a community member wanted to try something like this, Neil, where do they start?
Well, you know, start with your extension office. I know a lot of 4-H youth development educators around the state, this is something they do, and they could help you with that. Or there's specialists, and they can put you in touch with people like myself who could help you with that, too. Obviously, you're going to need city leaders, government leaders, city councils, county board members. You need that political capital. And you need some of those leaders to give up some of that political capital to the young people and help them build some social – help the young people build that capital so that they have some power too. So you're going to need school boards. Schools are really important. You need them on board because they can get you access to the kids that would be interested in something like this. But then, like I said, look for the kids who might be doing things like this already or start small and look for small projects. But anywhere where there's – a place for kids where you want kids' opinions, plug them in and start asking.
Ken, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234 as we talk to Neil Clemmie, 4-H Youth Development Educator for the Iron County UW Extension, talking about how communities are trying to provide places and activities for teens, and Neil and others working with teens themselves. Neil, this sounds like quite a civics lesson for the kids themselves. I mean, because you're talking about doing all the stuff that anybody would have to do to try to make a change in their community.
It is. And they, a lot of times they don't understand what it all goes into these kinds of processes. They don't understand, you know, when a community wants to put, you know, renovate their downtown, what all goes into that, how much money that's going to cost, where are you going to get the money from, and who needs to make the decisions to make that happen. So this has been awesome. A lot of the kids have really learned a lot about, you know, a lot of it about the challenges that go along with it, but also, you know, the steps that it takes to make things like this happen. So I think it's been great. And, you know, it's also grown into a possible, our county board is about to approve positions on our county board for youth. So youth will get an even deeper look into county government and how decisions are made.
Weird from Kristen. She messaged us to say, I had the chance to work with Neil and a group of 4-H youth on the design for a trailhead in Hurley. The kids were talented and an incredibly deep knowledge about their community. They floored the Wisconsin design team members with their ability. So yeah, I was just talking to you, Neil, about the learning opportunities for the youth. Sounds like the grown-ups can learn a thing or two here, too.
Well, I absolutely, and I think that's important. Is, you know, a lot of adults are impacted by this stuff. Adults like to be to feel like they can give back to the next generation. They like to feel like they can be mentors to the next generation. So I think, and it's always cool for adults to see what the next generation can do and to be a part of building that up.
And we've been talking about your work there in Iron County, but you told me actually that there are things like this going on around the state, and there was a statewide gathering in Madison bringing together people to share their experiences with this.
Right. There's it's a event called the Youth as Partners in Civic Leadership Conference. It's organized by a group of kids from all over the state, actually, and it's held at Upham Woods in Wisconsin Dells. That's kind of been its home the last few years. Matt Calvert he's a state specialist in the University of Extension in Madison, and he helps those kids put this together. And they come up with a theme every year, and it's really important. The kids really hit on some hard issues. You know, there's kids from urban Milwaukee to rural Iron County has been there several times. So kids get to see where each other come from and, you know, what their backgrounds are.
Weird from Mary on Facebook, who asks, how else does UW Extension involve teens in their communities, things like local government participation, et cetera?
Well, before coming here to Iron County, I was a teen court coordinator in Oconto County, and there's several county extension educators who head up a teen court program where juveniles, are first offenders, get a chance to make up for their offense and get that taken off their record, and they go in front of a group of their peers, and so kids get a chance to participate in the judicial system. There's, like I said, there's other youth and governance programs where county boards create space on the county board for young people to sit and serve on committees. Every county has a 4-H program that is built on youth development and creating places for young people to be leaders, either at the club level, at the county level. So every county has a program like this with their 4-H program.
Neil, before we wrap up, I want to head back to the Trailhead Project in Iron County. Last we mentioned that it had been designed. Where is it now?
A month ago, we purchased the property to develop the trailhead, the part that comes right into Wisconsin. So if you drive through Hurley, you'll see this open field on the right side. It's now owned by the city. So we can start developing plans. We've got the engineer firm that we're working with is developing plans and kind of using what the kids and the design team designed to kind of move forward and give us a trail a park there.
Do I remember right? Coming from the teens' ideas, there's going to be a fire pit involved in this. This was a place they wanted?
That was one of the designs. There was to be a fire pit so that the kids could come there and hang out. Right now, they hang out in Walmart until the police come and shoo them away, or they hang out at the visitor center, and they really wanted a place where they could come and kind of hang out. It'd be public, so they can't get in any, they wouldn't get in any trouble. They just want a place to be hanging out.
And when we were talking to those high school students, when you mentioned that, I mean, jaws dropped, eyes lit up. They love this idea. There's a hunger for this kind of participation and kind of project, just briefly, isn't there, Neil?
Yeah, there is. The kids in Princeton had some great ideas.
Well, we'll leave it there, Neil. Thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Neil Clemmy, 4-H Youth Development Educator Department Head at Iron County UW Extension. He joined us to talk about efforts to incorporate teens into local planning sessions. When the second Wisconsin Capitol in Madison burned to the ground in 1904, it caused a lot of despair for the people of the state. But on the plus side, its demise led to the construction of the building that we know and love today.
A new Wisconsin Public Television documentary about the Capitol will premiere on Monday, November 27th at 7 o'clock. Host Michael Bridgman is with us to give us a preview. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So you are hosting this wonderful new documentary about the Wisconsin State Capitol, and this is actually the third Wisconsin Capitol. What happened to its predecessors?
Well, it's the third, fourth, or some people say fifth. I don't know where the fifth one comes from. But it's the third building in Madison. The first one was built soon after Wisconsin became a territory and Madison was established as the capital in 1837. Apparently not a terrific building and supposedly got the nickname of Doty's Wash Basin or something like that for James Duane Doty. And so by the 1850s, they replaced it with a new building that was a sandstone, nice sandstone building designed by a Madison architect. Finished off by another architect. It was completed, I think, by the late 1850s. And there was a fire in 1904, which did serious damage to much of the building. And I think there a commission had already been established to look at either improvements or replacing the building. Well, that gave them cause to basically replace the building completely. And that process, they did proposals and looked at proposals from various architects and so on. And then I think the actual construction got underway in about 1906.
And as you said, this is the third Capitol in Madison. We should give a nod to Belmont, Wisconsin,
yes,
where the first Capitol is. So, of course, in any kind of a project like this, especially such a prestigious, important project, choosing the architect is really a key part of the process. How was George Post selected?
I don't know all the details of the process, and we do get into that into the program to some degree. They did basically a competition, and I think they did two rounds. I think in the first round, they didn't come up with, if you will, a winner, a final choice. And again, I don't know all the details about that. But when they did it the second time around, George Post, who was a very important architect out of New York City, won the competition. He came up with really what is a brilliant design in many ways. It's a grand building, and it is beautifully sited with that St. Andrew's cross, the cross with the four equilateral arms, if you will, set dead center in the Capitol Square. And it reflects very much the time in which it was designed, the early 20th century, when this whole so-called Beaux-Arts revival was going on. And Post got it down. He knew what he was doing, and they took his proposal. Daniel Burnham was one of the persons who had to do with reviewing this. And people may know Daniel Burnham's name because he was really the driving force behind the World's Fair in Chicago in 1893, which was a very big deal, not only as a fair, but its impact on architecture in America as well. And they picked a winner when they got Post.
Something that really struck me watching the documentary and made me laugh, actually, they talk about how it's in an X form and how it can be very disorienting when you're inside trying to figure out where you were. And I thought, I am so happy to hear it's not just me. I get so turned around in there, but it's because it's not... It's the same shape, but it's not set up like a cross. It's set up like an X.
Exactly. And I mean, you're right. In the documentary, a number of people, including people who work there, talk about getting disoriented. It is, fortunately, on the main level, they have light covers that have the street names on them, which really helps, because if it weren't for that, I would often not be sure where I am.
One of the things I found really interesting was the variety of materials chosen to furnish the building, and that each wing was given its own character by using only one certain palette of stone. And I thought that was so interesting because you go from being kind of disoriented by direction to being able to tell where you are by the look of it. Did one wing stand out to you or speak to you particularly?
I don't know if a particular wing stands out. There are spaces certainly in the building, because when you're in the public spaces, they look pretty much the same. But when you get into the particular chambers or rooms, they're quite different. The governor's conference room, I think that's the name of it, is spectacular. But one of my favorite rooms is actually, I think it's the North Hearing Room. That's what it's used for. It's used for hearings, but the way it is decorated, between the color palette, which includes not only the painting, but also the marbles that are used, but also the paintings themselves, which I think are wonderfully capture sort of the time of the early 20th century. There's something very optimistic and refreshing about them that I just love. I think that room is terrific. And most of those rooms, that room certainly, I think, and I know the Supreme Court Chamber have skylights over them too, which adds color and light in a different kind of way.
We're talking with Michael Bridgman. He is the host of an upcoming Wisconsin Public Television documentary about the Wisconsin State Capitol titled Our House. And Michael, I was amazed to learn that 50,000 school children or students a year tour the Capitol. Do you have a sense of what seems to strike them the most?
My sense, and we follow one of those groups. It's impossible almost to be at the Capitol, during the daytime, and not see groups of kids there. And it's fun to watch them because for a lot of these kids, this is their first time ever in the building. And they are just struck by it because it's not like anything else they probably have ever seen before. They seem particularly taken by, first of all, the rotunda space and the dome because it's so tall and so big. And they love some of the details. The tour guides say that they particularly like finding the fossils.
Mm-hmm.
There's some fossils, like a sort of a starfish thing is one that stands out for me, that you can find in the building. And they love to show the kids where that is or ask them to find it because they love this stuff. The details, both the bigness of it all and some of the little tiny details appeal to the kids a lot.
I think it's fun to see those school groups because, as you said, in the rotunda, they're fascinated by the height and the grandeur of it, and they're often laying on the floor looking up.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's great that they do that. That's what they should do, lie down on the floor, look up and say, oh, wow.
It really is a wow building. And what about you? I know that you're quite an aficionado of architecture, and I'm sure you've visited the Capitol many, many times before you hosted this documentary, but were there things that surprised you about the building?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You're right. I used to live only a few blocks away from the Capitol and would sometimes cut through it on my way home from work, get warm during the winter, partly. But in spite of that, in spite of how many times one may be in it, go through it or whatever, there are still things that surprise me about the building. Part of it is because in this program, we got to go places you don't normally go. The oculus, which is the top of the dome, for example, with that painting that's way up, I think about 200 feet over the floor below. That is open to the public, I think, to some degree. But I'd never been up there. And so it was great to get up there. A little dizzying if you look over the edge, but it's really wonderful. And I think what I was struck by, you know, it's one of these buildings where you can look at the details, like the starfish and the steps or things like that. But there's a way to look at it where you don't really focus on anything. You just sort of try to take it in as a total thing. And that's what I was trying to do some of the time while I was there. And just the color, the arches, the lines, the light, everything works so well together. It's really stunning when you think of it as a total piece. It's very easy to focus on specifics, but try to think of the whole thing if you can. It's a little hard. It's best done in the rotunda.
And one of the things that struck me also is the name of the documentary is Our House. And it really gives a sense of this building, the grandeur of this building, everything it represents, all of the important work that goes on in it is for the people of Wisconsin. And it really is the house of the people of Wisconsin. And I did not realize this. It is open every day of the year.
It is. And it's very much, the Our House name is legitimate in the sense that that was really the intent, I think, of the people in government at the time and the architect, was really this does not only represent the people, but it is for the people. Remember, this was built at the height of the Progressive Era, which was a particular moment in time, not only in Wisconsin history, but elsewhere in the U.S. too. And this whole notion of opening up government to the people in better ways was part of what motivated the design of the building and how it is approached. And I think the building really captures it. I wrote a little thing for our program guide where I said that the four arms, if you look at them, they can almost be seen like arms reaching out to embrace people to come in. People tend to think of the ends of the arms, but if you look between the arms, it's like, to me, that's what they're doing. They're saying, come in. This is your place, our place. Come on in.
Well, Michael, it's a great documentary, and thank you so much for giving us a preview.
You're welcome.
That was Michael Bridgman. He's the host of the new Wisconsin Public Television documentary titled Our House, the Wisconsin Capitol. You can catch the premiere on WPT on Monday, November 27th at 7 o'clock in the evening.
Coming up, the daughter of civil rights attorney and state legislator Lloyd Barbie joins us to talk about her father's life and work. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time. The late Lloyd Barbie may not have been a household name, but he played a big role in Wisconsin's history. A civil rights advocate, lawyer, and Wisconsin state legislator, Barbie's life and career spanned many of the key social and political struggles of the second half of the 20th century.
And he was often right in the middle of those efforts. As a lawyer, he was instrumental in the court case that desegregated Milwaukee public schools. Here's fellow Milwaukee activist Father Grappi describing Lloyd Barbie.
He was a brilliant man. People looked at him at that time perhaps as being too radical. I don't think he was. He was fighting a school board that was absolutely unbelievable. They not only wanted to try to integrate the school system, they gerrymandered. I mean, you can assess the attitude of the school board at that time. In the segregated and intact busing. Can you imagine that, taking black students to an all-white school and not even allowing them to eat lunch at the school, putting them back in the buses, sending them back to the inner-city school to eat lunch? Well, that's what he was fighting.
And as a state representative, he championed a range of progressive causes, including access to abortion, reform of law enforcement and drug penalties, and even the legalization of marijuana.
Lloyd Barbie collected his writings, speeches, and other materials to document the issues of his time. A new book edited by his daughter, Daphne Barbie Wooten, brings that history together. It's titled Justice for All, Selected Writings of Lloyd A. Barbie. Daphne, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Your father did a lot.
Yes,
a lot of different realms. Where did his drive come from?
He was born in Memphis, Tennessee, the segregated South. And he was an activist. He was a youth member of the NAACP back in the 1920s. He was born in 1925. And the South was extremely segregated. They had separate but equal, but it wasn't equal in the school. So he went to all-black schools. And he also went to a historically black college, Limon College, and decided that he would be an attorney and fight for civil rights. That's where his drive was born, if you will. Our family originates from Mississippi and northern Mississippi, Shannon. And their family got out of Shannon and moved slightly north to Memphis. And then from Memphis, he went to Madison, and then Milwaukee, three M's.
And what led him to come to Wisconsin?
He had relatives in Beloit, Wisconsin, and they told him that it would be much better off if he went to college, an integrated college at University of Wisconsin, Madison, for law school, and that he could stay with them for a while in Beloit, get acclimated to what was going on in Wisconsin. And he came here and was immediately discriminated against, which he writes about in his book, when his cousin Ambrose Gordon and he went to a restaurant in Beloit and were refused service on the basis of the color of their skin.
He came from a very segregated city, as you said. He ended up in Milwaukee, which was then one of the more segregated cities in the country and still is in many ways today. What was it like for him to find himself facing the same struggles in Milwaukee that he might have faced had he stayed in Tennessee?
Well, for one, he was an attorney at the time he moved to Milwaukee. He graduated from law school. He had already successfully sued in the city of Madison for its race discrimination in housing. And he decided then that he would go to Milwaukee and take up some more challenges. He was also not only an attorney, but a state representative. So he was able, through the legislative process, sponsor bills, bills demanding that schools, public schools, teach Black history, Native American history, demanding that the schools be more diverse, not only in their education process, but the teachers also, demanding that the African Americans not be shot by the police, which happened quite a bit in the 60s. So the Black Lives Matter movement is not a new movement. It started many moons ago. Emmett Till, for example, who was murdered in the South, and then continuing on through Milwaukee in 1967 when McKissick was shot by standing on the porch. He was African American man who was a junior in the University of Wisconsin system, and he was shot by the police twice. He didn't have a weapon. He was merely on his porch, and the police said, oh, that's justified homicide because it looked like he might do something to them. And that sparked the riots, much as it did when Rodney King was beaten, and they had the videotape of that, and the jury came back and said, oh, not guilty to the police officers. But at least in Rodney King, they brought indictments. In Milwaukee, they didn't bring indictments. They just said justifiable homicide. So yes, he went to Milwaukee and he enjoyed a good fight and tried his best to bring justice, which is in the book, Justice for All. He fought against the school board, which is extremely racist. As you know, in the South, during that time, it was de jure discrimination, meaning by law. Before Brown versus Board of Education, it was legal for the South to separate people by races. And in the North, they may not have a law on the book, but they still did it. It's called de facto segregation. It was segregation by fact. And the school board would argue, well, we're not intentionally segregating. This is what people like. This is what people want. And that simply wasn't true because, as you stated, there was intact busing where they would take African-American school children from predominantly Black schools that needed repairs, which happened quite often, and take them to predominantly white schools, and wouldn't allow them to intermingle with the other students. They had to have separate lunch times. They had to have separate play times. They had to have separate teachers. So it was separate. And it was an in-your-face type of a separate because it wasn't hidden away in another school grounds. It was in the public schools. And the whole thing was right out of something you would expect in the South. And it happened here in Wisconsin in the North.
We're talking to Daphne Barbie Wooten, talking about a collection of her father's writings, Justice for All, Selected Writings of Lloyd A. Barbie. Now, this is mostly your father's writings, but you write in the introduction a little bit about what it was like growing up. You were out there in the protests and out there facing an incredibly angry response. Can you talk about some of what that was like?
Yes, I can. I remember marching with my father, with my two brothers, and we were of young age. I mean, I think I was 11. And we marched first against the Eagle Club. I remember marching the Eagles Club. Eagles Club was a private club in Milwaukee that only allowed white males to be members and would not allow African Americans in unless they were entertainers. And so we marched to desegregate the Eagle Club. We marched for fair housing across the South Street Bridge. And I recall people yelling and jeering at us, breaking beer bottles, jagged edges of the beer bottles, throwing it at children, calling us an N-word, yelling just as you may see in some of the movies of the South or the Pettus Bridge, the marches across the Pettus Bridge in Alabama. That happened over here in Milwaukee, too. And so these are some of the things that I experienced as a child, and I learned that you have to stand up for your rights, even in the face of ugliness, racism, sexism. You have to keep going forward and stand up for your rights, because eventually there was a fair housing bill. My father sponsored it, by the way, that did pass. As you know, he won the school board case, although it took him over 10 years to do so. So it just taught me a lot of standing up for your rights and keep on marching and keep vocalizing and protesting. In the book, I recall that he'd go to Oshkosh, University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh, because 12 students, African-American students, demanded that the University of Oshkosh teach Black studies. And that was a radical idea, I guess, for the University of Oshkosh. And they had their list of what their demands were, and they were immediately arrested and expelled from the school at the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh. And my father represented them. And he brought forth a case which says you can't expel a student for protesting without a due process right, without a hearing. Show us which rule was violated. Give us proof that it was violated. And you have to have a hearing before you can expel a student. So he did bring this case, and it's discussed in the book.
I want to listen to your father's voice a bit. Here he is sharing his thoughts on people of color and whites in the civil rights movement.
As Father Gruppy moved on further, the times caught up, even in a place like Milwaukee, in a state like Wisconsin, where if one is going to be a leader of changes that relate to race, that members of that race should be the leaders. Really, if there's going to be any leadership, you certainly wouldn't expect it from whites, because if whites were leading blacks, we wouldn't have had slavery. And you certainly wouldn't have had to wait all the years we did after Reconstruction.
Now, going through what your father wrote here, what lessons do you see here for leadership in the civil rights efforts today?
Well, I see, unfortunately, a lot of the same problems that happened 40 years ago reoccurring. For example, my father was very much for birth control. And then in the book, he talks about how a lot of the other legislators first did not want to support birth control. And their reasoning was, if we give poor people birth control, then we won't have people to fight in our armies. That's pretty scary, because what it's saying is that we are keeping people poor to have babies and pregnant so that we can use them for the war machine. I mean, that's pretty clear. But the point is, we should not go backwards. We fought so hard for progress. We should be moving forward. That shouldn't even be a debatable issue, but it is a debatable issue. So that's one example, is that you just got to keep forward and hope that as you continue to struggle and search for justice and fight for justice, that eventually it will stick.
We'll leave it there for now. Daphne, thanks so much for coming up to the studio today.
Oh, thank you for having me. Aloha.
Civil rights attorney Daphne Barbie Wooten is the daughter of noted Wisconsin civil rights activist Lloyd Barbie. She edited a book of his writings called Justice for All, Selected Writings of Lloyd A. Barbie.